A plan to help an additional million low-income Floridians purchase health insurance has failed. The legislature rejected an expansion of the traditional Medicaid program early on in the session, but there had been some hope that the House and Senate would agree on an alternative. The Senate wanted to take $51 billion in federal Medicaid money and help people purchase private plans, but the House refused those dollars. Governor Rick Scott had pushed for the expansion, but some say he didn't push hard enough. Here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at the first days of the Medicaid talks, followed by political scientist Carol Weissert. Medicaid has come to dominate headlines in the first week of the legislative session, dividing Florida's Republican lawmakers and sparking talks that an expansion of the program under the federal health law could be dead on arrival. The House opposes the expansion. The governor supports it. And while the Senate has yet to state its position, that chamber's leader says the writing is on the wall. Here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at the week in Medicaid.
The House kicked things off Monday when the committee charged with exploring the Affordable Care Act said the state can't afford to expand Medicaid. In speaking against the expansion, committee chairman Richard Corcoran likened it to the state's $20 billion class size amendment, saying Floridians can't afford that same kind of growth in Medicaid.
We have a situation where you're going to have tons of people. This is good. Let's do it. Let's do it. And then 10 years down the road, as numerous representatives said, this is dollars that compete for education dollars. These are dollars that compete for every other dollar in the budget 10 years from now when maybe the estimates are way off.
Opponents worry if more people are allowed into Medicaid, it would crowd out other critical funding areas and hurt the private insurance market. Under the health law, the federal government would pick up all additional costs for the first 3 years and 90% in the out years. House Speaker Will Weatherford doubled down on that opposition Tuesday. In opening remarks, he told a personal story of how, when he was 15, his 13-month-old brother Peter died of cancer at a time when his family was uninsured.
I don't know the specifics of what happened. I know that my brother had cancer. I know we were uninsured, and I know they weren't able to pay the bills.
Weatherford said the family relied on charity and safety net services to cover more than $100,000 worth of bills, but he neglected to say what that safety net was, the Medically Needy Program, which gives Medicaid dollars to fund poor families who aren't poor enough to qualify for traditional Medicaid. Meanwhile, Governor Rick Scott, in his State of the State address, reiterated his support for an expansion of Medicaid. The governor, who often talks about growing up in a poor family, says he knows what it's like to be uninsured.
I cannot, in good conscience, deny the uninsured access to care.
While all this was going on, Senate President Don Gates spoke to reporters. The Senate panel looking into options under the Affordable Care Act has yet to state its position on the matter, but Gates says he sees the writing on the wall, and it doesn't bode well for Medicaid expansion.
It takes three yeses to get to yes and one no to get to no. And it sounds to me, from what I heard today stated in the Florida House, that the House of Representatives and the Speaker are inclining toward no. And if that's the case, then nobody else gets to bat. The lights get turned off and we all go home on that issue.
In previous comments, the chairman of the Senate committee, Republican Senator Joe Negron, had said the state can't just say no to Medicaid expansion without having an alternative plan.
The concerns about Medicaid expansion are very real and very legitimate. But I don't find persuasive the idea that we just have to have people go to the emergency room when their 11-year-old kid has an earache at 2 in the morning, that's the best we can do. We can do better than that.
Some lawmakers say the state should look to Arkansas, where the federal government recently signed off on letting that state use Medicaid money to steer low-income people into private health plans. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ronald J. Eben.
And that brings us to where we are today, in a bit of Medicaid limbo. We now turn our conversation to putting this all in context, and for that, we're joined today by Florida State University Professor Carol Weissert. Dr. Weissert, welcome to It's About Florida.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So it's been a really busy week. On Monday, the House came out and said no. On Tuesday, House Speaker Will Weatherford came out and said no. The governor clearly says yes to the expansion. And the Senate President Don Gates is saying, well, you know, two yeses and one no. The no basically tanks it. What in the world has gone on this week?
Well, you know, Medicaid is such a tremendously important issue to the state of Florida, as it is to all other states, that whenever anything happens in Medicaid, it's huge news. And this issue about whether this really is a key issue, whether the state decides to expand the Medicaid program over the next few years. And so this is the issue of the session, and anytime anything happens related to it, it's a big deal.
You know, something interesting that happened on Tuesday was House Speaker Will Weatherford. He recounted this story about, you know, when he was 15, his younger brother, who was about 13 months old, died of cancer, and he said the family was uninsured at the time, and, you know, they had to rely on safety nets. And later on, the Times Herald Bureau contacted his father, and his father said, well, we use Medicaid. And then come Wednesday, you see the speaker kind of issue this statement that says, well, we were on the medically needy program, and that program is funded by Medicaid dollars.
I thought it was interesting in two reasons. One is it really illustrates that Medicaid is so complex, you know, that people really don't understand that medically, you know, the medically needy is an important part of Medicaid, but it sounds like it's something different. And the second thing is, I think a lot of times these issues are kind of under the surface, that people that really benefit from them don't recognize how important they are. And I think both of those issues, the complexity and this notion that Medicaid, everybody hates Medicaid, but people really don't know perhaps the details of how it operates. And I think both of those things really augur against Medicaid because people don't really understand it well, and maybe even the legislature doesn't understand it that well, this issue.
And it's interesting because now, you know, you have lawmakers saying, especially on the Senate side, that committee's chairman, Joe Negron, had said earlier that, you know, the state can't just say no to expanding Medicaid without having a backup plan.
Yeah.
And now you have, you know, some people banding around, well, maybe we should look at Arkansas.
Yes, or Indiana or a variety of these other places. My problem with that is that we have a 60-day session, and what we're into the first week of that 60-day session. And I don't know, these committees have been meeting, they've looked at these areas, and to bring on these kinds of issues late in the game is, you know, seems a little, it's going to be a little difficult.
Something that's kind of lingering out there is Florida's Medicaid managed care expansion. Now, the federal government has given us provisional approval, but they haven't, you know, given final sign off onto this. Could that come into play later on?
I suspect it can. You know, all these issues are going to involve federal-state negotiations. The Indiana plan and the Arkansas plan are all under negotiation between the federal government and the state government, keeping in mind Medicaid is a federal-state program. So I think this is another one of these negotiations that are going to be taking place to finalize the approval for this area, and how it relates to these other issues is really an interesting question that I don't think we can resolve at this point.
Well, Dr. Weiser, thank you so much for speaking with us here on It's About Florida. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And as we said earlier, both the Medicaid expansion and alternative plans have failed, leaving people who would have been covered by the federal health law still without insurance. Lawmakers are now discussing the possibility of a special session. A plan would have to be in place by the end of the year in order for the state to take advantage of the federal Medicaid money. Senate President Don Gates and House Speaker Will Weatherford named an overhaul of the state's ethics, elections, and campaign finance laws as their top priorities. Spurred by reports of public officials mishandling state money, along with long lines at the polls this past November, Gates and Weatherford promised changes. Governor Rick Scott has already signed off on an ethics bill mandating tighter reporting requirements for lawmakers and giving the state's ethics board more teeth. And he's also agreed to raise campaign contribution amounts in exchange for more transparency. Early on, we spoke with Integrity Florida's Dan Krasner, Progress Florida's Damian Filer, and Phil Claypole, former executive director of the Florida Ethics Commission. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen, and thank you for joining me here on It's About Florida. Today, we are talking about three issues which sort of flow one into another, and that is ethics reform, campaign finance reform, and elections reform. We have on the line here Mr. Dan Krasner, who directs the Integrity Florida Group. Mr. Krasner, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lynn. Good to be with you.
Wonderful. And we have Mr. Damian Filer here from Progress, Florida.
Thanks for having me.
And we have Mr. Phil Claypool here, who is a former member of the Ethics Board.
Right. I was the executive director and general counsel of the Florida Ethics Commission until I retired in 2011.
Both the House and Senate have made ethics reform a priority, and I want to start off with the reason of why. And we know that we've had issues arising with lawmakers in the past that really kind of triggered this. You talk about former speakers having to step down. Talk about some of those things that kind of led up to this conversation that we're having here.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, as you allude to, and these, unfortunately, these things are not in the past. We've just had the lieutenant governor of Florida step down, and we currently don't have a lieutenant governor because of that. The House Majority Leader, Steve Precourt, is moving a bill, House Bill 655, this year, that would have the purpose of which is to preempt any local government from enacting their own ordinances. And the focus of it is to kill an ordinance that was proposed by Citizen Initiative in Orange County to provide earned sick time for the workers in that county. It should have been on the 2012 ballot. The county commission there defied their own charter to keep it off. And while that commission meeting was happening in last September, where they should have referred it to the ballot, Steve Precourt was in that room, and he was involved in what's called the TextGate scandal, where lobbyists were texting with the members of the commission. One of those people that was in that TextGate scandal was Lou Oliver, who's the chairman of the Republican Party in Orange County. And his comment to the commissioners at the time was specifically, he said, just delay this long enough that Tallahassee can provide the kill shot, meaning that if you don't put this on the ballot this year, we'll make sure it never goes on the ballot. Well, Disney was also one of the key interests that was involved in trying to stop that ordinance from ever making it on the ballot. If you take a look at Precourt's business, he currently has a lobbying business that has had close ties over the years with Disney. And here he is as the majority leader of the Florida House right now, moving this legislation that is the kill shot that will, if it passes this year, ensure that over 52,000 citizens in Orange County who should have had their day at the ballot box will never have that opportunity. These are the kind of things that if we had meaningful ethics reform and an ethics commission that really had teeth and could look into these types of things, I would like to think we would be looking into them now.
So, Mr. Filer, you say that there's a clear conflict of interest in that. So now I'm going to ask the question to Phil. So what would happen? Do we have any way to address this kind of thing? Or is this one example of something that would basically go off without a consequence?
Right now, the law regarding the State Ethics Commission is the same as it's been since 1975, which is they can only investigate when they receive a written sworn complaint about a particular situation. Both the House and the Senate ethics bills would change that slightly and allow the commission to investigate on referrals that would come, for example, from the governor or FDLE or a state attorney. But there's nothing in the works currently that would allow the Ethics Commission to initiate an investigation on its own.
So, Mr. Krasner, what do you think the legislature is doing that is going to be good policy related to ethics reform? And what area would you say lawmakers should look into strengthening? And I'm going to ask this question on everybody. So we're going to start with Dan.
The most important policy proposal that our lawmakers could move forward on, which they've failed to do just yet, is to join the 30 other states that have ethics commissions with the law enforcement authority to initiate ethics complaints on their own. 30 other states are already utilizing stronger ethics law enforcement agencies than Florida. It's time to join those 30 other states.
And Mr. Filer, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would very much agree with Dan's points here. When you look at the fact that Florida is the most corrupt state in the nation, I hate to be cynical, but after working in politics in Florida for many years, the fact of the matter is that politicians are going to act not because it's the right thing to do, but because there's enough political and public pressure for them to be in a compromised position politically if they don't do something to address it. The concern here is that they will put up window dressing instead of enacting meaningful reform. And I know you wanted to talk a bit about election reform, but it's a good example, if I could segue to it briefly here. which state was the only state in the country that still didn't have their act together on election night and couldn't report their results for days until after the election ended. It was Florida. And the reason for that is because there was a lot of window dressing put up after the 2000 election. And then later there was actual meaningful reform that was undone by this governor and legislature. A lot of the things that had actually made our elections work more smoothly were taken away.
We've seen over the past few years as each election cycle comes, more and more money comes into the process. And last year, last cycle, we saw record spending from outside groups, and a lot of it coming from, as Mr. Claypool talked about, these CCEs, these Committees of Continuing Existences. Dan?
Okay. So there's always cracks in the system, ways for money to flow in like water. So the lawmakers are considering, should the $500 limit on candidate accounts be raised? The Senate and Governor Scott appear to want to maintain the current caps on candidate accounts. The House is more inclined to raise what you can give directly to a candidate. Integrity Florida has recommended that campaign contribution limits be completely eliminated because we need to stop the shell game. Let's have full 24-hour disclosure. And if we had candidates raising and spending their own money, they'd be more accountable. We'd hear, "I approve this message," more often. That's what we need to see. The present system just appears like money laundering. It'll continue the same way if we pretend to have caps on some accounts but unlimited flow of money through others. The corrupting influence of money in politics is the defining issue of our time. But there's not a way to get the money out. So let's just put sunlight on it, and let's lift these artificial caps that just aren't working. Integrity Florida would recommend lifting the contribution limit and having 24-hour disclosure.
Governor Rick Scott has already signed the ethics and campaign finance bills. The elections bill is awaiting his signature. Finally, Florida lawmakers have been trying for years to reduce the size of the Citizens Property Insurance Corporation. The 2005-06 hurricane season caused many of the nation's major insurance companies to flee the state. Citizens used to be the insurer of last resort, but it's now the largest in the state with more than a million policies. Some say that's left Floridians on the hook for billions of dollars in liabilities. And this year, the legislature passed a bill aimed at reducing the number of people on Citizens and steering them back into the private market. We spoke with Jay Lyles of the Florida Wildlife Federation and Dr. Jerry Parrish of Florida Tax Watch. Greetings and welcome to It's About Florida. Today we have joining us Dr. Jerry Parrish with Tax Watch. Greetings.
Thank you.
And we have Jay Lyles with the Florida Wildlife Federation. Greetings to you, too.
Thank you, Lynn. Good to be with you.
Today, we are going to be discussing some proposals that deal with Citizens Property Insurance Corporation. Citizens is the largest property insurer in our state. It has about close to 1.3 million policies that we are, as taxpayers, if you're carrying any other kind of insurance policy, you're pretty much liable for. We have a couple of problems going on. Number one, we have a shortage of property insurers in our state. And there's also concern about the liability, financial liability, that Citizens is carrying. So give us a rundown. How did we get to this point?
Well, after the series of hurricanes in 2004 and 2005, the legislature began to see that property insurance was going up tremendously. And a special session was called. And they put the mechanism in place to have Citizens take on a great deal more of the exposure by taking more policies on. And while there was a small amount of opposition to this because some people understood what the ramifications might be in the future, overwhelmingly the legislature supported that plan. And thus you saw the exponential growth of Citizens Insurance, and it went from insurer of last resort to, in many cases, the only insurer in many parts of our state.
There was an exodus of insurers after, I think, 2004-05. We saw several big names. I mean, I remember we got excited last year when State Farm said that it wouldn't pull out completely.
And with that was a change in the whole market, because if you can't keep your rates actuarially sound, you're not going to be able to do business. And so you had private insurers competing with Citizens Insurance and losing.
Dr. Parrish, let's talk about Citizens' rates. As they stand, we've all heard that they are not actuarially sound. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that basically they're too low?
Yes, what that means is over the long run, they won't be able to pay their claims based on the reserves that they're generating. And what's happened in Florida recently is the money we should have been saving for the next hurricane, a lot of that has gone to sinkhole claims. And so we're not really increasing the reserves of Citizens by a wide margin.
What's happening in the sinkhole market? One of the big high-profile events that just happened was the story of the man in Tampa who was asleep in his bed and literally a sinkhole opened up under his house.
Yeah, that's a difficult market because things like other things that are liabilities for insurers are pretty easy to predict. They can predict things like automobile claims and the amount of houses that will catch on fire and burn down and those kind of things. But there are two things that Florida has a lot of risk on, and that's hurricanes and sinkholes, and both of those are very difficult to predict.
And that's a matter of Florida's geography. We sit on top of an aquifer, and clearly we are in a hurricane path.
Yes, exactly true.
Is it just too risky to live here?
19 million people say that it's not.
All righty. So,
but there is a cost for living in paradise, and Citizens Insurance didn't recognize that cost, and that's what we've got to balance right now.
So enter Senate Bill 1770. This proposal is quite large and it does several different things. One of the things that it does is basically say for new policyholders, you will have to pay a rate that is, I guess, fair market price for what you're getting. But what does this mean in terms of real numbers? I remember when I was shopping for a house here in Tallahassee, one of the things that they told me to estimate was calculate $1,500 for your property insurance a year. How does that weigh to what we're talking about in a Citizens policy? What exactly is, you know, an actuarially sound rate?
Well, quite honestly, it's different in different parts of the state. The gap between what homeowners are being charged and what an actuarially sound rate is. So it's difficult to say statewide because it's significantly different, say, on the southeast part of the state of Florida. You have a high concentration of Citizens policies there, and a lot of the studies that I've seen indicate that that's one of the areas where the gap between what they're being charged and actuarially sound is large.
Well, let me ask you guys this. I was listening in to the Senate Democratic Caucus, and you had a couple lawmakers who live in places like Fort Lauderdale and Miami, and the conversation went like this. You know, one lawmaker from the north said, I don't know why, you know, we have to subsidize people who choose to live in McMansions, you know, in the south. And the lawmakers from the south said, my property insurance rate just went up to $6,000, and I have, you know, a $200,000 home. That's just an example. So is that what we are talking about here?
Yes, in some cases. Some of those changes have come from citizens reevaluating those policies and some of the discounts that they gave for mitigation in the past, plus some changes in the way they calculated replacement value of homes. And so some people have been shocked by the big change in their policies coming in once they've been renewed.
And Lynn, this brings in the reason why a lot of the conservation community got behind this bill. What we're attempting to address in a market fashion is the fact that people want to live right on the coast. And oftentimes that's in low-lying, flood-prone areas that not only provide great wildlife habitat, but they also provide us with protections. These barrier islands are the most effective source of protection against flood and wind. And as we develop them, then we're losing that protection and we're losing that recreational land and the wildlife habitat. And so when we have listened to the debate in the legislature, it's been about stopping the bleeding, quit digging the hole deeper, that is citizens insurance. And one of the – clearly the low-hanging fruit here is that land right on the coast in these coastal construction control line areas and in our coastal barrier resource units in the state that we should not be building in those areas. And we're talking about where the waves meet the sand. And if you as we have proposed in the bill, if you say that new construction, not existing homes, but new construction would not be eligible for citizens insurance unless built to Code Plus, or as we would prefer, just not eligible for citizens insurance, then you would give people the price signal that says maybe it's not smart to build here. Maybe we should be considering building a little further inland. And so that's why a lot of us think this is the way to go with citizens insurance.
Senate Bill 1770 by Republican Senator David Simmons is now awaiting the governor's signature. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Taylor Cox provided technical assistance. Please join us again next week for more discussion on the issues impacting our state.